Well, Linda will be back in just a moment with more stories, more mysteries for you. The last few she's talked about have been absolutely staggering. So we'll be back with her in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Our next series of reports with you, Linda, they take us way up in the sky looking down, don't they?
Yes, but in a way, kind of remarkably back in time in order to put some context about how mysterious this truly is, the story about the Middle East and these patterns in lava. And I don't think many of our listeners would know, because I've only been learning this myself, that 25 million years ago, there were repeated volcanic eruptions in what is now modern-day Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. There were so many volcanic eruptions that today there is one huge, gigantic, black basalt field. It covers at least 100 miles or more in a region that is called Harat Hasham. Lots of the basalt has broken up over time into very jagged rocks. If you go to Earth Files, you can see a couple of these photographs. I've done a part one and a part two on all of this with the scientists who are doing the research with many photographs. And when you look at the jagged black lava rock that these strange patterns that we're going to be hearing about are sort of, you might say, put into the rock, but you can't see them. You're standing there. You cannot see any of what we're going to be talking about. And the extent of this, from Syria through Jordan into Saudi Arabia, they keep finding more and more and more, George, and they're doing it through Google. They are doing it through the Google Earth. They're now being able to see things so clearly.
Amazing.
And, of course, to go into Syria politically is not very feasible. Jordan is definitely an ally. Saudi Arabia depends. And so now with this wonderful new tool, the archaeologists are being able to discover things that they have never, ever seen before. And there are literally thousands of these strange circular patterns, many with spokes like a wheel, that are found throughout this gigantic volcanic field in these three countries. And it is, in a way, an enigma similar to all the stories you've heard about the plains of Nazca, which I go into in great detail in this Earth Files report. But the plains of Nazca are quite different from what we are talking about. And the first people to see any of this were the Royal Air Force pilots from England in 1921 after World War I. They were flying a mail route that went from Cairo to Baghdad, and here they were seeing these strange circles, large. Some of them are 300 feet in diameter.
Jeez.
And they are divided like you would make wedges. Maybe like a pie with narrow, think of a pie that is cut with narrow slices. And one of the pilots named Maitland, he was so completely baffled by all of these patterns in this dark black lava that he actually took photographs and wrote up something for the 1927 Journal of Antiquity, which still has the original report now archived online, and I got a link to that at Earth Files. Well, there were other investigations in the 70s and 80s by a woman, Professor Allison Betts from the University of Sydney. She was trying to understand how Iranian and Mesopotamian cultures had emerged and evolved, and she was baffled by these strange circular patterns. And then, while she was there, a young Scotland student named David Kennedy was completing his PhD in 1980 at Oxford University in England. His subject was Roman history and archaeology, and he first taught in England, and then he went on field trips to Jordan. And he was very interested in the fact that the Roman Empire included Arabia for 500 years, that in which Jordan was part of that, which means the Romans had influence on that part of the world. By 1990, he became a professor of classics and ancient history in the School of Humanities at the University of Western Australia in Perth. And his emerging passion was to study aerial photographs of the Middle East lands that were either so difficult to reach on foot or politically. And he explained to me, quote, "I was given a lot of photographs by the Jordanian army in the 1970s, old survey photographs. It was the interpretation of those that began to reveal just how many thousands of archaeological sites there were in Jordan. I've been working there every year since 1976 and some in Turkey as well." And then in the beginning of 1997, the Jordan Air Force began to fly Professor Kennedy every year in what has become the only program of aerial archaeology outside of Europe. Recently, only a few days before he left Perth, Australia, for another trip to Jordan, Professor Kennedy talked to me about the mysterious lava rock patterns that have kept him returning year after year, and the exhilaration of his first flight with the Jordan Air Force in 1997. Here now is Professor Kennedy.
It was wonderful. I was being taken for the first time flying over this landscape that I had wanted to work on for over 20 years. Nobody had done any aerial archaeology there before. I was being flown in this old American Huey helicopter over these archaeological sites one after another, and it was absolutely wonderful. Not just the Roman sites, but these wheels that turn up in the basalt desert as well in large numbers. So it was one of the most exciting days of my academic career. Fortunately, it led on to annual flying that we were allowed to do every year from 1997 until today.
How many of these, what you're calling wheels or circular patterns in the flat landscape, do you think there are in Jordan and Syria and Saudi Arabia?
The area of lava that we're talking about is called Harat al-Sham. It spreads across from southern Syria, across through the Jordanian panhandle, and into northern Saudi Arabia. It's one large lava field. In the Jordanian part, these wheel structures, I would guess that we're talking about 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 of them.
These wheel-like patterns can only be seen from the air, correct?
They're very difficult to identify on the ground. And at ground level, one of the groups of them that we've looked at, something like 38 of these wheels in the group. If you're standing beside one, you can perhaps just discern that there's a second one 200 or 300 meters away, but you won't see anything beyond that. You'll be almost completely ignorant. There's a 36 beyond that, because today the walls of them stand, you know, perhaps 50, 60 centimeters high.
Why would people 2,000 to 9,000 years ago be making all of these thousands of patterns in a rocky lava to be seen only from the air?
I thought once they might be fairly elaborate burial places, but I'm moving away from that idea as well now, because I've not seen a single example where you can demonstrate that there's been a burial there. So at the moment, I don't know what they're for.
Is there anything carved in rocks or caves or any information from that 2000 to 9000 period that might even suggest why thousands of these would have been made?
There's nothing that I know of, and I've looked at the literature written by prehistorians who specialize in the Middle East, and I've not seen anything there that would offer an explanation. We're still searching for an explanation. The pilots, when they asked Bedouin back in the 1920s, "Do you know these structures in the desert?" The answer was yes. The Bedouin knew that they were there. Europeans were just discovering them, but the Bedouin had always known that these things were there. When they asked them, "What are they?" the Bedouin didn't know. Their answer was, "They're the works of the old men." That seems to have meant, because you get the same answer coming up in Saudi Arabia as well in relation to similar structures there, that seems to mean that they think these structures are pre-Islamic when they talk about the old men. Not part of the region since the arrival of Islam in the 7th century AD. They belong to the period before that. Field work that's been done since then, that is the case. They're not only pre-Islamic, but they're pre-Roman, and quite possibly pre-Roman by 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years.
And that's how you get to possibly as old as 9,000?
Yes.
And what about the plains of Nazca in Peru, south of Lima? I have flown over them in a small plane, and I have seen how they are pressed into the ground.
They're quite different. I quite often refer to the Nazca lines. That's not because they're the same in any way. You know, we don't have any exotic birds or fish in the patterns in the stone structures in the Middle East. I refer to the Nazca line simply because what I'm seeing in the Middle East seems to me to be something equally deserving of attention. They are so numerous, they extend over such a large area, and they're considerably older than the Nazca lines. You know, the Nazca lines, as I understand it, date back to a period of, what, about 1,500 years ago, give or take two or three centuries. What we're looking at in the Middle East is much older than that. It's much more extensive. It's over a far larger area, and there are far more items in the landscape. So it's not that the two things are in any way the same, except as a major phenomenon that is very much deserving of attention. And while everybody has heard of the Nazca lines, virtually nobody's heard of this material in the Middle Eastern deserts.
Throughout the history of the world, though, there has always been a fascination by human cultures with the sky and stars and constant references to star people and certain constellations like the Pleiades and Orion. Is it possible that in both these cases, Peru and the Middle East, that these were made having something to do with star people or the stars?
Someday somebody may come up with a fine explanation for it, but at the moment, I don't know what the answer is.
Well, I understand that there are stone circles also in South Africa, extremely ancient and worn down. I wonder if there is a period of time in the 2,000 to 9,000 years when there were stone circles all over the planet.
I've been shown photographs of the South African material, and it doesn't look particularly like the structures that we've got in the Middle East. Stone circles are not uncommon. There are large numbers of them from the Bronze Age and Iron Age across Western Europe as well. Stonehenge, everybody's heard of. We just have a quite different form in this part of the Middle East. I don't know why it is. People that you're talking to on the ground there, they've never seen these things from above. So they don't realize just how numerous they are and how strange they look in their patterns.
So even the people who live there today are not aware that these pattern structures are in the thousands throughout that lava bed?
Almost certainly not. The few people I've talked to about these things, they're sort of mildly interested, but it's part of their landscape. So they pass on by, as I did for many years when I was only looking at ground level. It's only when you get up a little bit above it that you can see that there's shapes to these individual structures, and they're really quite fascinating.
What are the next steps in your own research?
I'm going on Friday back to Jordan for the next season of flying. We'll spend probably at least 2 days of our flying in the basalt area again, recording these structures, drawing up a very detailed map of where they are and putting that into a GIS, a geographical information system, to see if an aerial interpretation can begin to shed light on what these things were.
Who were the humans who made thousands of wheel-like circles in the black lava rocks of Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia 9,000 years ago? I asked Professor Gary Rolofson, Ph.D. in the Department of Anthropology at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. Professor Rolofson is a prehistorian who has worked at stone circle sites in Jordan and describe for me the people who lived there so long ago. Here now is Professor Rolofson.
Probably they had brown eyes because they don't seem to be Europeans. Probably they were about the same size as we are. We have an awful lot of 7,000 to 8,000-year-old burials from a site I worked at in Jordan called Ain Ghazal. And looking at the different skeletons, we can tell they were pretty healthy. By 7,000 BC, they were already taking sheep and goats out into the desert to take advantage of their winter rainfall. There have been calculations that something between 2 to 4 tons of wood and brush a year that a family of five would have used for cooking, for processing plant foods, for heat, and for light. So that 4 tons per year per family is 4 trees per year. And when you see some of these settlements that were like 500 to 1,000 people strong and start doing the math, we're doing an awful lot of deforestation, which is opening up soil to erosion by wind, erosion by rain. So they moved into areas that had not been as intensively farmed for as long a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So by 7,000 BC, it was getting really kind of precarious because sheep and goats were competing with farmers for land. You have to keep the sheep and goats out of the fields, but where are you going to take them? And the best place to take them is out in the desert, where seasonally there's both water and vegetation during the rainy season. It begins in October probably and lasts until maybe March. And there are a lot of areas out there with slight depressions that in Arabic is called Qa, Q-A, sort of like mud flats or playas, where water collects in these ponds.
In North America, there were what the North American Indian called medicine wheels. And there is that word again, wheels, because these were very old patterns of rocks in the North American landscape that had the lines emanating from a center core out to a rim. Then there are the stone circles from Europe, even into South Africa, going back to that period of time. The plains of Nazca, I understand they may be younger, but it all adds up to this same issue that around the world a long time ago, there have been patterns in rocks or imprinted into the Earth's surface that could only be seen from the sky, and that all these thousands of patterns in Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia would fall into that category. Why do you think that all of these cultures would have been making patterns in rock and the soil that could only be seen from the air?
One of the things about the circles is the circle is one of the easiest geometric designs to make symmetrically, because all you need is a rope and a person standing in one place and another person walking around with that rope stretched, and you've got a perfect circle. It resembles the sun and the moon. It's difficult to say what the symbolism might be for some of those things. But the Nazca lines, that is a big problem, because I agree. If you're standing on the ground there, you can't see the hummingbird, or you can't see the monkey, or you can't see the spider.
Right.
So that's a big question, and I have no answer for that. But for the desert out in Jordan, I would say that circles are easy to make. Now, what the function of the circles are, nobody's excavated one, to my knowledge. So we don't know whether or not these were animal enclosures, perhaps, with dividing some animals according to the families that were living together at that time. And when they brought their sheep and goats back, they may have stuffed them in one of these pie slices or something, each one for a family. It's really difficult to say what these circles meant to those people.
Is it possible the mind of humans then had a more intimate relationship with the sky?
Well, it's very possible that these things have some sort of celestial relationships, but how can we ever demonstrate them? These wheels, of course, are much too big to be structures.
Yeah, many of them are the size of football fields.
Yeah, absolutely. The two we did, the diameter was about 100 meters.
And George, that's 300 feet. And I'm looking at a photograph from a report that Professor Rolofson did called Ein Gazal Excavation Report.
Mm-hmm.
And it is an assembly of some of the plaster statues that they have found 9,000 years old of the people who were there, who must have made these patterns, one must assume. And what is so interesting is that you are looking at heads and eyes that are eerie. And from the context of who has interacted with this planet over eons, and you look at these very large eyes with these thin, narrow iris pupils on very long necks, sort of beautiful people, but sort of strange and eerie looking. And you wonder, who was inspiring the people of that part of the Middle East 9,000 years ago?
Mysteries of this planet, to be sure. More stories with Linda when we come right back. Well, next hour, we'll have conversations with Linda, sort of open line calls with her. And if you're a whistleblower, of course, we'll always take your information. By the way, we've gone over 100,000 Facebook followers. I want to thank all of you who continue to support us that way. And we're only 9 away from making it 100,000. Does that make sense? 101,000. That's all we need. So just go to coasttocoastam.com. up there in the right-hand corner, click the Facebook icon and just click the like thing and fill it out, and off we go. And we'll be back with Linda in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Strange things in the skies. Here's Linda with her final report. What do you have, Linda?
Yes, when I was in Australia in July, I heard a lot of stories about strange aerial phenomena up in the Northern Territory, which includes Alice Springs and the Pine Gap, the National Security Agency center, sort of right in the middle of Australia. And if you go to earthfiles.com, I have a map that shows exactly where the Northern Territory is, and I have a map also that shows the relationship between some of the towns in the Northern Territory and Alice Springs that is not far from Pine Gap. And when you consider that the Northern Territory of Australia is 521 million square miles, but it has only 229,000 people in it, it is the least populated of Australia's eight major states and territories. And according to local residents who live there full-time, including a man named Alan Ferguson, UFO activity in the Northern Territory sky has increased over the last 5 to 10 years for unknown reasons. Now, Alan was born 47 years ago, and he has lived not very far from Darwin, about 25 miles, since 1992. He was originally born in Melbourne at the southern end of the big Australian continent, but he never liked cities. So when he started working on house renovations in a town called, literally, Humpty Doo on the map, and I said, was that from the Humpty Dumpty fell on a wall? He said, that's right, Humpty Doo. He wanted to stay there, and he became passionate about the big dark sky at night full of bright stars without competition from city lights. Well, he loves photography. He loves photographing the world around him, and one night during a fierce electrical storm that happens a lot around Darwin in the Northern Territory, Alan Ferguson put his camera on a tripod for some time lapses of the dramatic light, and then he was puzzled to find black disc-like spots in his photographs. And that started him photographing the sky over and over, whether he saw anything with his eyes or not. So now he sets the camera on a tripod to continuously shoot at about 3 frames per second for 200 frames. He does this over and over and over again. And to his increasing astonishment, when he downloaded images to his computer, over the past few years, he has accumulated dozens of photos that show variously shaped and unidentified aerial objects. And recently, he sent me a few to discuss in an interview about his ongoing efforts since 2006. The first time he's gone public was then. And he's trying to share information at a website of his that I have a hot link at myearthfiles.com to his. And he would like to inspire others who have never talked to come forward and share their own photographs and experiences in the Northern Territory, because he knows that other people must seeing and experiencing what he does. And for the past decade, Alan has watched and photographed so many strangely moving objects in the sky that he insists cannot be terrestrial. So here now is Alan Ferguson from his home southeast of Darwin in the Northern Territory of Australia.
The maneuvers they can make, you know, they can just bounce straight up, straight down, and straight up again in just a split second. To give you an idea of what one looked like, if you get a McDonald's cheeseburger and you take the beef patty out of it and put red and white lights that spin around really fast instead of the patty, that's what it looked like. But the craft was very metallic. I'd be sitting watching in awe, just looking at this craft, and they just disappeared right before my eyes. One was seen by a lady just down the track at Darwin River about a year ago. It was like a spinning top. Like an orange lava lamp in the center of it, and down below had a really bright red light spinning or flashing on and off. The whole thing was orange.
And then on the bottom of the glowing orange, there appeared to be red lights that are spinning around in the bottom half.
That's the one.
And this is the one shaped like a child's toy top?
That's exactly right. Okay. And they wobble. They go up and down and sideways. I was watching it because I lined it up against the tree. It was wobbling behind the trunk of the tree. They go left and right, up and down. It was a beautiful sight.
Well, let's talk about the photos that you sent me. And I have listed 1, 2, 3. One is the bowl-shaped craft over Acacia Hills, and the date is June 21st, 2008 at 3:04 p.m. Could you please describe how you came to photograph this and what was going on?
I could see these flashes in the sky, just little flashes. That's what gives them away. Every time they move, they flash. So I just shot off well over 200 frames, and out of that 200, I think I got two on the same day. I didn't see the craft. I only just seen the flashes. And then once I download them on the computer, there they were.
This is the bowl-shaped craft. The next one was June 21st, that same day, but about a half hour earlier. And this object, I think, in the photo you sent me, looks like a helicopter.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that. But one frame, they're there, they're not.
Almost as if they are fading in and fading out.
Yeah, they're just there because it's either blinking on and blinking off or fast.
Okay, let's talk about the third photo, which was taken on July 20th, 2008. We're a month later, and it is what appears to be some kind of a triangle in the sky. Can you please describe what you were doing and why you came to take this photo, and what were you seeing?
Well, at the time, I didn't see the triangle. I had no idea it was actually there. There was just a little bit of a flash, because I just know that they're up there.
When you went to the computer and found this frame, and it looks like a kind of orangey-colored solid triangle, what was your reaction?
Oh, my God. There's another one. That was my reaction, because I know they're there.
Alan Ferguson kept his increasing sightings and hundreds of photos to himself until 5 years ago, when he decided to create a website to see if others in the Northern Territory had similar experiences they might share. One man who did come forward was a cable technician who finally has now reported a dramatic light encounter that haunted him for a decade. His name is Aidan Pegram, and in late July 2000, his wife had given birth to a daughter. Mother and newborn flew to Melbourne to join parents while Aidan was able to get some time off in late August 2000. He drove from Darwin in their car to join them so all could return together. Aidan reached Tennant Creek, not far from Alice Springs, around 7 p.m., checked into a motel, and was back on the road about 3 a.m. August is winter in Australia, and it was cold, but the sky was clear and full of stars. Recently, Aidan agreed to talk with me for the first time on the record about what happened next. Here now is Aidan Pegram from Northern Territory, Australia.
I was driving down the highway and I noticed a light behind me, and I could see it in the mirror, and I thought, oh, someone's got very bright headlights or spotlights on their vehicle. And then the lights became brighter, and I was travelling at a fair speed, around 100, 110. Couldn't go much faster because of the kangaroos and wildlife on the road at that time of the morning.
You mean kilometres per hour?
Yeah, kilometres per hour, yeah. And the light became brighter, and I thought, wow, they must be going really fast because they're catching me. The light's getting brighter. I had gone around a corner or a bend, and the light was still in the mirror of my car at the same spot where it was before I'd gone around the bend. And I thought, something's not right there. Something's amiss. And then the light was getting brighter and brighter, and I looked in the mirror again, and the light was not on the road level of the mirror, but the light was in the mirror at the top, as if it was in the sky. There was a bright, like, yellow-orangish light, but if you looked at it, it was, like, pure white, like a really, had a really white sort of glow about it. Started to get a little bit freaked out by this. So I went faster, and the light was still getting closer. I'd gone around corners, and it was still there. And then the next thing, I look at the mirror, and the light was almost lighting up the car. It was hugely bright. Something's going on here. The UFO or something. And I thought, no. I said to myself, no, not me. Pick somebody else. Don't take me. I want to go see my daughter. Leave me alone. And it was hugely bright. And it was like, I thought at the time it was the noise of the tires on the road making it like a drone, a really sort of droning noise. When I think back now, I think, well, maybe that was making the noise, that light.
Can you try to mimic the sound when you say droning?
There's like a deep sort of drone. I looked in the mirror. It was still there. It was almost like it was 400 metres behind me because I could see it up high. I had to crouch down in the car to look at this light. And then in an instant, it was gone. Like in a flash, it was like completely before your eyes. It disappeared completely. And I slowed down and I stopped and got out and had a look, and there was nothing. I looked behind me. There was no car headlights, no truck headlights, nothing in front of me, and it was just completely black. All you could see was the stars, and that was it.
Do I understand that light had paced you, staying with your car for at least a half hour?
Well, at least, yeah, it would have been at least half an hour.
Could you talk a little bit more that a light is orange, but when you stare at it, it's white?
Yeah, it had like an orange, yellow-orange glow to it. A bit like at night time if you look at a bushfire or something on the horizon and you can see that orange, yellowish sort of the fire. But if you looked at the light itself, it was like looking at a high-wattage light bulb that was so bright, like pure white and bright, almost to the point where it hurt your eyes to look directly at it.
Right. During that period of time when you were mentally sort of yelling out, no, don't take me, I want to go see my baby daughter, did you have any sense of thoughts in your mind that might have been telepathic from something in whatever this aerial craft was?
No, I didn't feel anything telepathic. My mind was sort of focused on not being captured or not being pinned down by whatever it was. My thoughts were, escape at all costs, no matter what. I've got to get away from this damn thing. You know, I can't let it catch up to me or get me.
But it had already proved to you that it could stay up with your car no matter how fast you went or whether you made turns.
Yes. Well, that was even the more scariest part, because no matter what I did, it was sticking with me. I had no chance of outrunning it. I'd tried to do that. And so it was fixated on, obviously, me and checking me out and seeing what I was all about. That was my first experience with anything. And now I experienced it myself. It's like, wow, hang on. I mean, if you think how advanced intelligence and their technology they have compared to us, I mean, it'd be like comparing a human to, a primate or something. I mean, they obviously are far more advanced than what we probably ever will be. So I don't see them as being a threat, because if they were a threat, they could have wiped us out a very long time ago, if that's what their intention was.
And they could have lifted you right off from that road if they had wanted.
No doubt they have the ability to teleport or something, or they can do space travel at phenomenal speeds that we will never achieve.
And that the very fact that you communicated, at least mentally and maybe verbally, to whatever that light was, to leave you alone, and that seemed to be respected, also, I think, is an important part of your story.
Yes. My theory is they've been here from day one. They've had something to do with the way humans have evolved, and they're just keeping an eye on how we go about things. And also, they're just abducting people at will, and it's been happening for hundreds of thousands of years.
And George, Alan Ferguson sent me a photograph that he took in May of 2011, and it reminds me a great deal of what was in Stephenville, Texas, about 3 years ago. And if you go to this report at Earth Files, I have a large photograph under May 2011, Unidentified Lights. And you look at it, and there are those squiggly, or however you want to say, Stephenville, the people had a hard time trying to explain. Mm-hmm. They'd be seeing lights that had pulsing lights coming out in different colors and making shapes, and some people thought symbols in the sky. Well, in this is a time lapse, and he said this is important because he had never seen these combinations of lights in the sky in a time lapse before this year of 2011. This is a first for him. And when you look at this photograph and you read his explanation down below, his camera's on a tripod always, and he is taking, in this case, it was a 10-second time lapse. Well, look at how many things are going on in the sky. There's that green line that he doesn't know what made it, but look at the strange, if you want to call them squiggly, they remind me very much of the Stephenville lights. These are more white. Stephenville were more colorful. But all of this comes down to the question, what is it that seems to be, I'm going to use the word, increasing in frequency. Perhaps people have more ability to photograph than ever before, and that is a large part of this sense that there is more and more activity in the skies. But Alan Ferguson has been in the Northern Territory since 1992, and he feels that from his point of view with his eyes, that he's seeing more and more in the sky, and he's getting more and more in photographs when he can't see anything with his eyes. And he and others, when I was in Australia, they asked me about Pine Gap. And I put a photograph in my Earth Files report tonight that I found. It's the same road that Aiden was on that night. And here is a big sign on that road: no through road, Joint Defense Facility Pine Gap, prohibited area, turn around now. And when you go and do some research on even what's out there in the public about Pine Gap, you read that, for example, Wikipedia says, quote, it's a commonly used name for a satellite tracking station and gives the latitude and longitude about 11 miles southwest of Alice Springs in the center of Australia. So Aiden was not too far north from Alice Springs in Pine Gap when this strange light paced his car for a half hour. And it's operated by both the Australia and the United States. However, I've read a story in the New York Times about the fact that the United States negotiated a treaty with Australia. I think it was back in the late 60s or early 70s, somewhere in there, where we would literally own Pine Gap as a territory at the center of Australia. And what is interesting is that the more you read about it, you find that it is described by people who have worked in other military installations as being similar to the American Signals Intelligence Facilities at Buckley Air Force Base in Colorado and Menwith Hill in the United Kingdom, and that the personnel at Pine Gap from the United States are largely National Security Agency and some Central Intelligence Agency, and NSA dominates. So what all are we tracking from the center of Australia?
Good point. Linda's next. Conversations with Linda. Your phone calls. We'll be back.